This is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 9. You know, that feeling of anticipation when you bite into the first strawberry of the year, or use your bare hands to pull a carrot out of the earth, brushing the dirt away with your shirt tails, and just revel in that sweet, satisfying crunch. Is there anything that compares to that? That kind of stuff just makes you happy to be alive. This episode is my first time interviewing two guests, the inspiring women behind Huckle and Goose. Their work revolves around taking the guesswork out of making dinner, doing it healthfully and mindfully, and with a farm-to-table approach. So come on, let's go talk about what's for dinner. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast. Welcome back to another episode. Thanks for listening in. This week, I'm talking with Christine and Anka, who together created a meal planning website focused on eating locally produced seasonal food called Huckle and Goose. I love the premise behind Huckle and Goose. They chose the name after Christine discovered gooseberries and, having never tried them before, fell in love. For her, wild foods like Huckle and Gooseberries that are not conventionally grown are the beating heart of seasonal eating. You can't buy this stuff. You have to wait. And oh boy, when it's here, it's just so good. Christine and Anka launched Huckle and Goose with the hopes of helping many others eat seasonally, but they've taken it a step further by working in convenience too. They've scoured the web and through a network of dozens of contributors, including cookbook publishers, they've compiled a seriously wonderful list of recipes where they then pair up to create menus. You get a complete shopping list each week and away you go. No more struggling with what to make for dinner. Of course, right now, with all this snow on the ground, it's tough to get back to that taste of that fresh carrot. But the earth is always spinning and spring creeps ever closer. Huckle and Goose also helps navigate the winter market, giving you options for all those winter greens and squash. We also talk about how to get kids to eat their vegetables and what to do when they just won't, because sometimes that's okay. We talk about why music in the kitchen is so important and what it's been like to get a brand new business off the ground. But before we dig in, I'm also really excited to share that Anka and Christine have generously offered Pure Green listeners 35% off a one-year membership with the code PGMPODCAST. Get details and links in the show notes at puregreenmag.com/podcast/hucklegoose. So, let's go to the interview. Here's Anka and Christine. Help us get to know you. So, who are the girls behind Huckle and Goose?
I guess I'll start. So, I'm Christine Lukacu, and Anka's on too. We're both sisters-in-law. I'm married to Anka's brother, and we just really love cooking. I remember when I first married Andrew, and I should go back to the fact that, I mean, I grew up in a house where we really didn't eat meals together at the table very often. And then I remember going to Anka's house, and she just would always just make it a point to have dinner together. It was just, I mean, it was a thing that always happened every day. And I remember thinking that this is how I want my home to be. When I'm married, when I have kids, I just want to have meals around the table all the time. So I started cooking too. I think for probably the last 5 years, we've just been, you know, talking about food and figuring out a way to go into business, a business revolving around food. So we would always just throw around ideas. And you know, it was the perfect time for, Huckle and Goose just this past year to launch it. So, yeah, this is where we are now.
And what about you, Anka?
I was, born in Romania. I mean, we're both, Christine's first generation here. I was born in Romania and came when I was about 7 and a half. So initially, I was born around, you know, locally sourced produce, literally the backyard, and my parents raised chickens, and we had pigs in the backyard, mostly out of necessity. It was communist, so everything was, you couldn't really find anything in the store. And if you did, one of the memories of growing up before I went to kindergarten, my grandma would wake up at 4:30 in the morning to go get watered down milk and wait in line for hours just to get as part of the process. But growing up around this, it was eating exactly what was in season and everything else was preserved. So the only time I saw strawberries in the wintertime was when they were in jam. So I grew up around that. It seemed normal. It didn't seem, except for the orange I got at Christmas, which was probably the highlight of all my Christmas presents because those were never to be found. And then we moved to the States and things just were drastically different. I mean, America for my parents, for everybody's dream leaving Romania was, you know, the land of milk, honey, and processed foods. It was so exciting to come over here. And to this day, walking into, I think it was a Dominick's, just a grocery store in Chicago, we went in there. First, obviously, the automatic doors opened, and I just could not believe that not only were there fruit, but there was food I've never seen, pineapple and all this stuff, and then just aisles of milk, but not even just milk. There was like 2% skim, and I was so confused, and then obviously the ice cream aisle sent me through the roof. I was so excited, but even with this, we came from the whole organic eating at home, eating naturally, what was in season, but when we came here, my parents, it was tough working. They were both working, trying to make ends meet. They were learning. My mom learned English watching soap operas. My dad taught himself English just reading the dictionary. Never took a class. Anyway, once we got here, things were different. And some of it was just ignorance on their part. They just didn't know that eating, you know, macaroni and cheese instant, they thought this was like the new thing. America must know better, so this is what we're going to be feeding our kids. And I grew up a lot on frozen meals or Kraft, and some of it was economic and some of it was, no, this must be good, this is America is advancing. So, and then from that, as I grew, and then the cooking shows kind of came on and the farmers market was more prevalent, and I started cooking and I realized, no, this tastes way better than the jarred. No offense to Prego, but just food tasted better. And we did have the privilege of going back. My parents started a nonprofit. So I would go back during the summer, and we would always say, gosh, food just tastes better. What is it? Is it the soil? And it wasn't necessarily. It was that we were eating it in season, and it was grown without pesticides in it. And there was care and love into food. So this whole long tangent to say, grew up around local food, then kind of lost our way, and then found it again once I got married and then had children. It was very important to me to instill these kind of food memories, and also knowing that food isn't just fuel, you know, it's nourishment, and you get it in such a beautiful way when someone puts care and love into it. And knowing where your food comes from is very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no kidding. Wow,
sorry, that was really long.
No, that was a fantastic answer, and you gave me so much in that answer. I wasn't expecting that. You know, and it's something, it's funny, I was just talking about this the other day with my family over Christmas, that I'm Canadian and I live in Canada, and it's one of the things about Canada, and I think the U.S. too, but especially Canada to me, it seems, Canada's a young country, mm-hmm. and nobody is, almost everyone can sort of trace back their fairly recent history coming here. And so, you know, but now it's several generations back. And so for you to have that direct reference from living in Romania to coming here, I mean, that must have been, well, you said what a stark difference that was. And so one of the other things that you said that struck me and sort of reminded me, I just completed an episode, it's actually going to be, it's airing now, with Ashley English of Simple Measure, and she is a homesteader.
Wow.
And yeah, and you know, that's a big part of sustainable living as well. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how, as a, you know, there's a huge sector of our society that's really striving to go back to that, and what's funny or ironic to me is that often that way of living is a result of poverty, mm-hmm. you know, having to do with less. And so you make do and you do it all yourself. It's just one of those funny things.
The pendulum swings sometimes. We get, industrialized and all this stuff and everything's great. And then we kind of lose our way, I think. So it's funny how we swing back, but it's exactly the case. I mean, in our case, it was poverty in the sense that mm-hmm. we just, not necessarily poverty because we lived okay. It was just, you had to, otherwise you weren't going to find potatoes at the store. You had to grow
yep.
it, but.
So not poverty, scarcity is better
yeah.
to say. And then, Christine, you also talk about the importance of eating meals together as a family.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, when I studied sociology, and that was one of the things that we really talked about was the importance of the family meal and how it really does influence so much, even academic success at school.
Yeah, it really does. I'd say, too, I mean, Anka mentioned I'm first generation born here, but, you know, I have a very similar food background, I guess, from growing up. But I didn't have, you know, Anka went back every year, even after she came to the States, but I didn't have that reference point. And I always joke, I mean, I didn't have a green leaf, I think, until I was like 18, 19 and went to college. But, you know, it's so important for me now, you know, one of the reasons we started Huckle and Goose was after my son was born, I just became very, very aware of, you know, and especially with all this information out there now about, you know, organic and eating locally. So I just became really aware of this and started shopping at the farmer's market every single week after he was born. I just wanted to feed him the best, you know, the best there was. And it's just been such a cool thing to see him grow up and, you know what a rutabaga is and like it, you know, or a celery mm-hmm. root. You know, we obviously, we go through a lot of stages. He's almost three, you know, so some weeks he won't eat what he loved the week before. But I just, on the days when, and, you know, I think dinner and meals look different for everybody, but I think on the days when I do plan and I do make something that day and we all sit at the table and eat together, it's just a different day. It's a better day. And I definitely see that in, you know, in the way I am and, you know, in my kids' behavior. So it's just, you know, and Anka reads statistics all the time about, she loves reading up about this stuff, but yeah, just how test scores are improved in kids and, it's just a really beneficial thing to gather around the table with family and friends.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And, you know, we haven't really dug into what Huckle and Goose is yet, but I don't want to forget this. So I wanted to throw it out there. You said, you know, you go through different stages with your son, but in terms of eating, and I'm like that. I'm right there too right now. My daughter is almost two, and you know, she went from eating every single vegetable out there to almost eating none like overnight. It's been so frustrating. So I think you guys should add a little archive of kid recipes on Huckle and Goose and some tips on sneaking in vegetables so that they're still getting them. Yeah, smoothies are my friend.
Yeah, that's so true.
I
think when it gets to be like 4 or 5 days that he just hasn't eaten anything, I'll definitely, you know, it's smoothie day. But it's, you know, it's trial and error. I think that whenever I feel like I get the hang of something, and you know, I found a recipe that I just love, you know, you get really confident, and then you know, they just they don't eat that way anymore, just like you said, but. I think for me, the key has been to just embrace the stages and realize that just because he doesn't like it now doesn't mean he won't in the future. And sort of the philosophy that we've adopted is that, and I should go back and say, when he would refuse something, I used to make him something different, and it just got so exhausting for me. And now with the second baby here, it's not possible for me to do that. So our philosophy is that we all need to eat what's at the table. And you know, he just has to taste everything. Sometimes he refuses to taste something, but, that's sort of what we go for. And, if he doesn't, then, he would have to basically go to bed hungry. And then, you know, just, he knows that he gets breakfast the next day, but, you know, and that was working for a while. Then he'd eat his food. And then, now we're in the stage where he's choosing to go to bed. So I'll put the food in front of him on his plate, and he says, "Mommy, I just want to go to sleep. I don't want to eat." And he would go through several days of doing that, and my husband and I would just look at each other and say, "I mean, we can't keep doing this." So now we just offer him a carrot. Like that's what we offer him if he doesn't want to eat what's at the table. And I feel good about that. I don't have to spend time preparing it. And I'm just okay with this phase, and you know, I hope it'll go away in a few months, but we'll kind of just play it by ear. I know that there's some statistic out there, and I don't know what it is exactly, but you have to offer something new to kids, or probably to anybody. I don't know, what is it? Maybe you know this, Anka, 12 times, 20 times, I don't even know, but
yeah, I don't know the exact number, but it's definitely more times than you think. It's not like three, and it's sometimes even cooked in different ways. I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, so I've been through numerous stages, but one of the things Christine and I realize that even if they go through these stages, it's so important to start them off super young, to develop their palate. I mean, obviously, if you're going to start when they're 10, you can do it. It's just going to be a little bit harder, most of it, because they've probably had a lot of processed food. And one of the things I think we also don't realize is juice has so much sugar, even if it's organic. And if your child is drinking a glass of juice with lunch or dinner, that's going to be really sweet. So if he's going to taste the rutabaga mash, it's not going to taste that great in comparison. And one of the things I actually really admire about Christine is Lincoln only drinks water like all the time, and he craves it and he doesn't think about anything else. And I really think it just kind of, it keeps his palate clean. So when he really tastes the subtle nuances of all these different fruits, it's different than having just juice. So I think one of the first, I would advise anybody who's trying to get their kids to eat veggies is honestly cut down the juice, or at least water it down. I used to, if they did have juice, at least get put, you know, half water in it and keep it, or they get one juice a day. So if they want it, the juice with lunch or dinner, but mostly try to keep it with water. And we're huge believers of getting kids to the farmer's market. It's so amazing to see when we take them and you let them pick. That's one of our things with our tote bags, is they get to carry their own stuff. Kids love to do it for themselves. They don't want your adult bag. They want their own little bag, and they love to pick their vegetables. And it's so simple. I mean, it's almost absurd how simple the concept is, but you know, they'll go over there, they'll pick the ugliest carrot they'll find and whatever other root vegetable they've never even heard of, will put it in your tote bag, and they come home and they can't wait to prepare it. And they're more likely to try it because we're all humans, and there's a sense of pride. I made this, so it better taste good. So it's in their mind, it's already preset that they're probably going to like it, and they're going to make you taste it. And I think it just sets, it's just this process of, it can't just be, here's a plate of food in front of you that may or may not be overcooked, or it may not even taste good. But if you get them involved from the beginning, and even, you know, maybe you can't go to the farm, but just at least to the farmer's market and ask the questions and pick the vegetables and then come home and prep it and then cook it as well. And I'm not saying that's easy, because I've had this conversation with Christine, when you see like these magazine spreads and these kids are like flour free with aprons and they're like perfectly dicing their vegetables. That's not my house. I'm usually like, oh my gosh, if you help me, it's going to take me another half hour to clean up all the peels that you just stuck to the, and it's not, I have to mentally say this is more for their benefit. Clearly it's not for mine. I mean, it's spending time, but usually it's just extra work on my end because I have to clean it. But I try to at least 3 times a week let them come in there, and they are eager. Actually, like Lucas always asks, okay, can this go up on Huckle and Goose? I concocted a recipe. Like that's his thing. I send Christine, he actually texts Christine the videos for her to approve. And he finally landed one on Instagram. But yeah. But anyway, so that's what I've seen just with them. And they have very different palates. But one of our rules here is to taste it. And sometimes I have them taste it raw before I cook it. And just get the conversation going, like what do they taste, what do they smell, and then when they have to at least taste it, and they have to tell me what it is that they don't like about it. And sometimes I'll figure out maybe it's the way I prepared it, so the next time I'll do it some other way. But and some things you're just not going to like. I hate bananas. I'm never going to like bananas. So obviously you can't force your child. But I have noticed, and Christine has too, is just the more you expose them, give it a try in like 4 days and just cook it with a different vegetable. And letting them pick the vegetables sometimes, that really helps. I'll say, what would you guys prefer, you know, Brussels sprouts this weekend? And I'll figure out how to work that in. But they honestly love Brussels sprouts. Like, that's that's their thing. Granted, we put it on pizza, and it's got bacon, so I guess, you know, that'll make anything taste good. But that's we're both firm believers. I don't think there's so much. There are picky eaters, but I think most of the time we kind of raise picky eaters in certain ways. It's either we don't know how to cook it, or we're just kind of forceful. Like, no, you better eat this, and this is how. There's like, I think there's a whole process, like the whole child, instead of just eat this because you need to. So, but it's a learning. It's definitely been learning for sure. I mean, it's taken me years to figure this out.
Yeah, I think definitely it becomes a power struggle, you know, with the pickiness and all of that. It's almost as much, you know, you're just allowing a certain type of behavior or habit to develop, really. Yeah, and I loved what you said about the juice as well. I mean, that's really important, I firmly believe. Water, 99% of the time. I found, just because my little girl's so young, when she gets sick, there's very little I can give her. So I give her juice for vitamin C. But then, and then it's always water with dinner. And that was a policy in my home as well growing up, was just juice was almost never, and always water with dinner for sure.
That's a great policy. So,
that's a good way to do it. So let's dig in, before that, just thank you for all that advice on getting your kids to involved in the kitchen. I really loved that. That was really wicked. And with Charlie, what I do is right now she loves to help me with the dishes. So I see it as like a stepping stone to helping in the kitchen.
Always.
For sure. Yeah. So let's dig in a little bit to what Huckling Goose actually is. So we've talked about it for a little bit now, but what is it exactly?
I'll take this, Anka. So I guess in its most basic form, the way we can describe it is that we tell you what to get at the farmer's market and then what to make with it when you get home. And we do that by providing curated recipe plans. And about a third of the recipes are from our food blog partners. We partner with, I think, 30 at this point, 30 just really awesome food bloggers. And then we have a handful of cookbook publisher partners too, and we select our favorite recipes from cookbooks they publish and put those in the curated plans as well, and then we develop about a third of the recipes as well. So every week we provide these plans. They're mostly plant-based, and we try to keep everything else in moderation: meat, gluten, sugar, dairy. We just think that I very strongly dislike the word diet, and we just believe that if you eat this way, it's just optimal for your health. So we provide these recipes, and then it all filters in into an automated shopping list. So basically the idea is you don't have to think about what you're going to buy at the farmer's market and what you're going to make that week, and you go shopping once, and then everything you need for the week is in your fridge. And the idea too behind choosing recipes from food bloggers and cookbooks is that I think when we embarked on this farmers market eating local journey, there is just so many recipes out there. So many. I mean, our Pinterest boards were overflowing, and I have at least 50 cookbooks on my shelf. And you know, the kohlrabis and the rutabagas were just going bad in our fridge. You know, by the time you decide what to make with something that is relatively unfamiliar to you, or you just haven't really figured out how to make it yet, it's just a daunting process. And I think the more we sort of put on autopilot, I would spend like hours meal planning. I want to play with my kids. You know, I want to do other things. I don't want to sit and think about for hours what we're going to eat for the week. So it's basically, we act as a filter for all these things that you have on Pinterest, for all the cookbooks you have on your shelf. And we just create an action plan of how to shop at the farmer's market and actually make things with them. So they don't go bad in your fridge. And then from there, I mean, you know, I think that filters into so many things. It could probably go so many different directions with this. You know, it lowers food waste. It's easier to gather around the table together and have those important meals together because it's just easier and you don't have to, you know, scramble to get to the grocery store because you forgot that one ingredient that you just forgot to put on your grocery list. And yeah, I mean, we could go so many different directions from here. But we just basically want to come alongside people and, you know, whether you're a seasoned cook and you just, maybe haven't cooked with mostly plant-based, foods before, maybe you have cooked with kohlrabi before, but you just haven't cooked with it that much, or maybe you're just a novice cook and don't even, when I say rutabaga, maybe you don't even know what that is, or what it looks like, because I know, you know, I did it during my first market experience, but we just want to come alongside everybody and at whatever point they are in their cooking journey, their farmer's market journey, and just provide really awesome recipes from everywhere and just make it easier for them to cook at home.
Mm-hmm. So basically you're a, it's like a meal planning website.
Yep.
That incorporates an app with, that helps, generate a shopping list so that that part is all done conveniently. But then you also through that encourage, farmers market, eating.
Yeah.
Type of thing, like farm to table approach.
Yeah. Hopefully I didn't ramble on too long to lose the, yeah, what we are, but yeah, that's exactly what
no.
we are. Yeah.
Yeah, no, no, you didn't at all. I mean, I appreciated all of that. And I loved as well how you work in the element of convenience. And, you know, yeah, we food is inspiration. And we're, you know, I think that it's normal to just devour it, you know, through the internet and all of that. But then when it comes down to deciding what to eat,
yeah.
It's hard. And so I love that element of convenience that you work in by choosing for you and making sure that it's balanced, making sure that that nutritional needs are met. And then the shopping element really attracts me too. I think that's so important. I mean, anytime you're trying to negotiate change, especially in an area that's so habitual, like what you eat,
mm-hmm.
Bringing an element of convenience helps a lot. I mean, it automatically takes away the argument of not having the time to do something, which is pretty common these days.
Oh.
Yeah. So why the name Huckle and Goose then? What does that signify?
My first market experience, I went with a friend and it was during the summer months. And one of the stands had gooseberries and I'd never heard of them before. I'd never seen them before. They looked so weird. I think I probably hovered over the stand for like a few minutes just looking at them. But I was intrigued and I brought them home and I baked a cobbler with them and just completely fell in love. And then that was sort of my farmer's market hook. And I just went back every week. And I think it was probably the middle of gooseberry season at the time. So they were available for a few more weeks. And I ate them every week. And then they were gone. And gooseberries are obviously, you know, they're, at least here in the States, they're not something, and in our area, they're not something we can buy at the grocery store. So I had to wait for them till the next summer. And that wasn't a way I was accustomed to eating, just that, you know, patience, just waiting for something to come in season again. So it just sort of sparked this, the idea that you can live in a way and cultivate this gratitude simply by waiting for what you eat. Yeah, it all started from that, gooseberry.
Huckleberry is the same kind of thing.
Yeah, it represents, yeah. You know, things you can't buy conventionally, and then the fact that the seasonal way of life just really trickles into so many different areas of life, you know, just cultivating this gratitude, this appreciation for the food that you eat, who grew it, and yeah, it's for me, I think I'm just the type of person that is, you know, on the go all the time, and it was just a way for me to sit and savor the seasons by eating this way. So, and that, you know, it's a lifestyle that we want to impart on other people and make it easier to eat this way, because it is intimidating. I think, you know, the first couple of years you do it, you're just trying to figure out what to do with all, you know, that heirloom produce and all the unique vegetables and fruits you find at the market, and it's just intimidating. And we sort of want to cut through all that so you can just start living that way and then, you know, cut through all the difficult part.
And just quickly, I think one of the best parts of the seasonal eating, obviously, is like you get cherries for like a few weeks and you're just eating and eating and eating and it's so exciting. But then with all this, it's like, okay, what am I going to do with a butternut squash? How many times can I roast it? And I think that was part of it. Like initially you get really excited about a season and you make something that's like your favorite dish for that. And then you're like, oh, it's like 2 more months of squash, especially in the winter months, you know? And one of the things I'm trying to fix is, no, I want to frequent the farmer's market and I want it to be a regular basis. And one of the things we try to do with Huckle and Goose is you're going to get those butternut squash recipes and we're just going to give you ways, totally different ways for you to cook it. It might be squash soup. It might be like a risotto with it. You know, we're going to give you as many options so you can really put those to use. And you can say, okay, I really did my part eating seasonally. And I think that's one of the things we were trying to fix, because we all have our go-to, but then how many times can you have butternut squash soup?
Yeah.
Yeah. That does remind me of, usually we're part of a CSA, community supported agriculture, where you get a basket of food direct from the mm-hmm. farmer. So you don't, it sort of eliminates going to the market, which is, you know, can be sort of nice depending, because I find the markets usually when I'm working. and depending on the time of year, like I know in the spring, it's just baskets and baskets of early spring greens. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh my goodness, like, okay, when is this going to end? It's awesome. But at the same time, I'm tapped out. So yeah, that's good. It's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I love your philosophy. I love what you shared there, Christine, about your reasoning behind the name. And you expand on that in your website a little bit, where you write that, you know, waiting for that wild foraged food to come into season, that cultivates that deeply rooted sense of gratitude and patience that is rare. And I agree. I mean, living in a society where food is so readily available from the grocery store, it does disconnect a person from the hard work of growing food. And working hard for something creates that sense of scarcity, which in turn breeds gratitude when you have those things. So you continue to write that this type of eating you want to bring back because it does so much more than nourish our bodies. So what did you mean by that, more specifically, and how do you hope Huckle and Goose can facilitate that change?
I touched on it a little bit, but I think I'm just the type of person that I'm just go, go, go all the time. And I need to find ways, I think, to find moments for myself and find moments to, you know, savor life, savor just everything that's going on in my day, you know, savor time with my children, with my husband, and just time to reflect. And I think that for going to the market and just really just getting my only options for what's in season, you know, if like right now I can't get tomatoes, I can only get root vegetables and potatoes and onions and that sort of thing. So my options are limited, and I just can really enjoy them. And like Anka said, you know, when you get butternut squash, you eat it all the time. And I think like tomatoes right now, I don't really even want them, because during the summer months, I ate them every single day and they're so amazing. And I think tomatoes are one of those things that are one of the produce where you can definitely taste a difference between what's at the grocery store and what's at the market. Mm-hmm. And it's just fully enjoying something, during a season and then, you know, moving on to the next thing. And I think it just really, I think eating seasonally too, just put, like you said, it connects you more to where it came from, and it connects you to the season. And I think eating with what's going on outside and in nature just kind of cultivates this more natural rhythm to life, if that makes sense. It doesn't sound totally hippy-dippy.
No, it doesn't at all. Of course not. I mean, of course, I subscribe to that 1,000%.
Yeah.
So, Anka, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Yeah. I've always made dinner's pretty big. Christine's we complement each other really well, because she's a big breakfast person. She makes time specifically for her family. That's the time for her, and she makes breakfast quite often. And then for me, it's dinner. No matter what, it's usually on the table. I'd say 6 times a week, with one day where it's probably pizza or takeout. But one of the things I've realized, it's become instilled in my children and a way of life where I do like to cook. It does get, obviously, sometimes you're like, I have to get dinner on the table. But it's the reward at the end for those times where I'm kind of like, I just want pizza today and I don't want to cook. When we sit down and you talk, you see your children, and statistics have shown, forget about, you know, as they get older with depression and that their grades are better and that they are less likely to take up smoking or drinking. I mean, it's everywhere. We all know it. It's just hard to do. But they also mm-hmm. talk about how it's a stress reliever for parents, for adults. Even if you work a full-time job, if you get a meal on the table and you sit around and you talk, it's easier to catch if your children maybe had a bad day because you see them, you talk with them. And one of the greatest things, I think, we get tutoring for our kids and we do all these things, but they say there's no better way for your child to learn and pick up vocabulary than speaking with adults. So when your child is 3 and you have conversations with them, they're going to pick those up and they're going to pick up this rhythm of life where you're going to take the time, look them in the eye and just talk about your day. And it could be nothing spectacular, but it's just become, and the days where I'm not, actually yesterday I was busy and I didn't get dinner on the table and they just both looked at me like, wait, what are we supposed to eat? We're all supposed to sit down. It's family time. So it's adorable to see that for a while it was just them getting, it's dinner time, we have to sit. But when I don't do it, it catches them off guard and they're actually longing for it. And that's when we say nourishing the soul it nourishes the family. And it's not just your kids and your husband. It could be your friends. There's something about breaking bread with other people. I mean, why we meet for dates, everyone always thinks about where are we going to go eat or what are we going to do? There's something about, and it builds on memories. I think all of us have memories of our grandmother or our aunt or somebody that made something. And no matter who makes it, even a chef, nobody can make it as good as them. It's because it's connected to love and there's this deep connection and it's profound. And I want to build these things for my children because I've had them and I want them to go along and remember what it was like to sit down and continue to share the meal. So I think it's so much deeper than just feeding, because I think we all know that. And I honestly believe that food tastes better when it's made with love or you take the time. And people appreciate that when you take no one does it so much. Your bowl of soup to your friend or a woman who's just had a baby, there's something that just connects. There's a sense of community in so many ways that is kind of forgotten now. It's really easy just to order food. And it's convenient, and that's wonderful for one of those days. But I think if the effort that it takes to maybe want to do these things, just the reward is so much greater in so many ways.
Yeah, that's a beautiful answer, Anka. And I agree. In episode 6, Claire Ragazzino and I talk about the importance of eating a meal prepared with love. It makes such a big difference. Mm-hmm. It's really important. And then, of course, if you're subscribing to Huckle and Goose and you have, you know, just what you commented on about the difficulty of getting a meal on the table, especially if you work mm-hmm. and you have kids, it can be hard. But if you're subscribing to Huckle and Goose, then, you know, that really helps in the organization. And although I don't do this, I wish I did, but I don't. But if you do your meal prep the night before, sort of after the kids go in bed, you quickly go chop up some stuff and have it all ready. And then it's just a matter of putting it together. I feel like that would make it sort of effortless if you could be self-disciplined enough to do it the night before.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm starting to try and do that, most just because I'm so busy. I have to do something because otherwise we're eating at 8, which Charlie should be in bed by then, right?
We talk about this all the time, and Anka touched on it too. You know, once Lincoln was, you know, 1, 2, I would cook dinner all the time. And now with Penelope here, I don't have that time to cook, you know. And I think dinner and meals together look different for everybody.
Yes.
For me, it's breakfast before the day gets out of hand. And, you know, because I often find myself at 7, you know, oh, the kids have to go to bed in half an hour and I have not started on anything. I have, you know, and for me, it's breakfast. I just make something a little bit more special every day. And then I just try to make dinner about 3 to 4 times a week. And then we're just kind of spontaneous with it the other days and, you know, look to healthy options in our area, or just eat leftovers or whatever it is. But, you know, like Anka said, she cooks almost 6 times a week, and that's just not doable for me right now. And I think it just looks different for everybody. But I think, you know, we always say too, it is just making it a priority. It's not easy to cook at home. You know, we try to make it easier, but it's definitely not. It's just, we kind of liken it to working out. You know, it's hard at first to get that mat out and to wake up early and work out. But after a while, it becomes second nature. And that's what we're trying to do, is just make this second nature. So it just, you know, it's weird for your day. Like Anka said, her kids are, you know, they miss dinner when they don't have it. So we just want, for ourselves too, we want to get in the habit of doing it more and more and more, and just impart that on others as well, make it second nature.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for noting that distinction. It is different for everyone. I think that's important to know. You can't compare your life in that way. It's just, yeah. And I think leftovers, it's funny. You hate leftovers as a kid, and as an adult, you embrace them.
That is so true.
Thank goodness for leftovers. Yeah. So, you know, a big part of your mission is encouraging farm-to-table eating. And so how do you advise people to negotiate that in the winter if they live in an area where there's no farmers markets or hardly any options in winter? Do you have any advice for them?
Yes, I would say, I mean, we're fortunate that, you know, I live in D.C. and Anka lives in New York. We both have access to year-round markets. A lot of the produce comes from, you know, root cellars and things the farmers have stored. But some farmers in our area actually grow things through the winter too, in the ground. They just cover the ground in a special way. But I would say in other areas, I think it's just, you know, eating a lot of grains and beans and, you know, things from your pantry. I've recently listened to the podcast you had with Amy Chaplin too, and
yeah,
she touched on this too. And I think it's just, you know, you will go through a few months where you just eat from your pantry, but, and we don't do this as often as we'd like to, but we really encourage the art of preserving and just preserving those tomatoes in summer, just lining your shelves with them, you know, canning them yourself, and jams and all the foods you can possibly get into jars to take you through winter. And we do that a little bit, but, you know, because we're fortunate and we do have this produce here. But like Anka said, in Romania, I mean, that's how you get through the winter when you have no other option. You know, here we're fortunate that if you can't truly shop locally and seasonally, you do have the grocery store, you know, where things are shipped in.
Yeah.
But to truly eat that way in regions where it's not an option, we do really encourage canning.
Mm-hmm. No, that is important to have that foresight and planning.
Yes.
For sure. Yeah.
Which is also very difficult to have. So maybe another aspect of our site for the future, how to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic idea. You should, yeah, for sure. Like, get people have a calendar. So sort of like gardeners,
yes,
have a calendar. Like right now or in about a month, you're starting your seeds. And so then same kind of thing. So get people like, okay, so this week at the market, you need to pick up a bushel of tomatoes.
Yeah.
And here's what you're going to do with them and stuff like that. That definitely,
yeah,
that would be a really great addition.
Taking notes.
Yeah. And I think as well, like, as this sort of way of living becomes more and more popular, at least I've noticed here where there is no farmers market, now they're starting to become alternatives, like sprouting, for example. So eating sprouted grains, pea shoots and sunflower sprouts and radish sprouts, all that stuff. That's one way. This is an incredible way, actually, of getting some of those nutrients in winter. And then aquaponics, too, are really starting to become more popular and sort of talked about more, which I can't wait to see develop further.
That's cool.
Yeah. So then you mentioned that a lot of your foods and recipes are vegetarian, plant-based, but then there's also meat recipes, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's good. I don't think it's the norm yet to have a plant-based diet, but how do you, do you have a way that you encourage people to source local, sustainable, healthy meat as well as produce? Or is that something you don't talk about quite as much at this stage?
I would say we don't talk about it quite as much at this stage. But if you do have vendors, if people do have vendors at their local farmers market, we suggest buying from them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're always talking about grass-fed beef and, you know, the locally churned butter and everything that we can get. So, I mean, when we do, it's implied when we mention milk or when we mention yogurt or anything, it's locally sourced. And if it's from a happy cow that was humanely raised, that's something that's very near. We're both not vegetarians, but as we started eating locally and eating in season, I just stopped craving so much dairy. I used to cook a lot heavier. I mean, I still, when I crave it, I still will make macaroni and cheese, you know, full on dairy and cheese and stuff, but I don't crave it as much. And it wasn't this mindful, I'm going to stop eating because it's not good for me. It just, no, I like the way it tastes. And then the more I started cooking, food that's in season, you doesn't need a lot of sauce. Actually, you're going to ruin it. Most of the time we're just drowning things, covering it up. And the more I cook this way, it's like my palate transformed or changed to these different tastes. So gradually, I actually crave meat less. I don't drink milk. I try to drink more almond milk. I can't give up butter just yet. That's my go-to. But in general, it's a way of life, and we're kind of nudging people towards that because I feel like it's a natural progression. For some people, cutting cold turkey is great, but for us, and diet is kind of subjective. It's not really, we don't want to just say diet, it's a lifestyle. So some people are totally for the raw diet and good for them, and some people are vegans and paleo, and we have all these tagged with the recipe, so you can swap stuff out. That's one of the great things that we wanted is, you know, maybe Wednesday, Tuesday is your pizza night. So you don't like the chicken recipe. Okay. You could swap it out with a different squash or a different vegetable. And that's mm-hmm. kind of, where we go with all this.
Mm-hmm. Another way to do the meat, thing is to buy shares,
yes,
as well, like locally, mm-hmm. and sort of during that harvesting period, you fill your freezer and then it's all just there.
We're actually looking forward to that. My parents are moving about an hour from DC in 2 months, and we're Christine and I are already making plans. We're like, okay, so there's gonna be a cellar, and we're getting mm-hmm. a deep freezer, and we've already have all the farmers we're going to. But that is in it. That's a great way, and that's good mm-hmm. for the farmer. It's good for everybody. It saves you time, and it's way cheaper.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, of course. So on your website, I mean, we're getting pretty close. We've been talking for a little while now. It's gone by so quickly, so I had a few questions to just wrap up with. I love how on your website there's this little section where you describe your favorite things. And one of those things are seasons, which, of course, you know, you become conscious on a whole new level when it informs how you eat. So what are each of your favorite seasons and why?
I think I wrote this on there. So I came from, I was born in Chicago and lived there for 20 some years, where it's pretty much, you know, nice warm weather for 3 months out of the year. And then it's just cold winter. I despise the winter growing up. And I think, moving here to the Northeast, it's just given me a new appreciation for each season and its time and just the different nuances. And, I think whenever I get asked this question, I just don't know. I love every season for what it is. Maybe fall, maybe.
That's what I said.
I just love the, here we have cherry blossoms in DC in the spring. They just flowers everywhere. Everybody plants flowers in front of their homes, their magnolia trees. It's just so colorful and so beautiful. And then summer is a bit humid, here, but it's so beautiful. And then fall, you know, sweaters and warm socks and root veggies. I love being inside and braising a beautiful cut of meat for hours, you know, and you just smell it, and then you have people over So I guess that kind of answers the question, but maybe leaning toward fall.
Mine is definitely fall and a little bit of winter, just when there's snow and it doesn't get too gray. I tend to be a homebody to Christine's dismay, and I love to stay home. So when fall arrives and it's like, I can go for a short walk when she drags me, but I love being able to come home and have the excuse of, well, I have to braise something for 3 hours. So I can't go anywhere. And I love the apple. I love obviously the color of fall to me is just the most beautiful. I mean, yeah. The oranges and the browns, they're spectacular. And my in-laws have a cabin in upstate New York. So when the seasons change, I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. I'm sure it's the same way in Canada. The crisp fall air, it's just kind of your soul kind of rests. I feel that you're it's not quite winter where you're hibernating. It's you're slowing down a little bit, but I love cooking. Cooking in fall is probably my favorite just because of the ingredients, and you're getting out of that heat of the summer and braising and sauteing. And there's apples. I'm a huge apple pie fan, so when fall comes around, it's like the perfect excuse to start getting pies in the oven. But yeah, for sure fall.
Yeah, it's hard not to love fall when, you know, especially for food reasons, because summer, if you garden or as a farmer, you're working really hard to bring that produce up and you're harvesting as you go. But fall is really about enjoying, like reaping the benefits
exactly,
of all that
yeah.
work. You just are, I mean, I know in my garden, it's like I have a tiny garden and I'm still giving away stuff. And when it comes, like when fall comes, I just have such an abundance in my little tiny patch. And that's
yeah.
just kind of fantastic.
Tomatoes. I mean, we still had stuff. We go to the farmer's market and we're thinking we have to change our meal plan Christine's like, no, I still saw tomatoes. It's almost October. There's still tomatoes at the farmer's market. So it has been pretty amazing to see. That is, I love that. Loving the abundance of fall and reaping the benefits.
Yeah, exactly. You also talk about music in the kitchen, and I completely agree. I don't know why, but music has this natural place in the kitchen. You know, sashaying to your favorite song while chopping, sauteing, or doing the dishes. It just injects that element of cheer into your food, which goes back to that element of cooking with happiness that we mentioned before. So what place does music have in your kitchens, and what do you like to listen
to
best?
My Spotify is on all the time. It's Apple TV, and then that is on the TV, so I always have it on, but it's usually... I love jazz, and I love like Sinatra and Billie Holiday and all these other ones. So that's usually when I cook, there's like a classy element to it. I have like a bunch. We actually do a couple playlists for Huckle Goose too. I'm a huge music fan, but it's very rarely pop. Usually that's like the least, but I would say, and then obviously during Christmas, that's all I heard.
Yeah.
It was like the old Bing Crosby and everything else. But jazz for sure, classical, and it really does. I think you walk in and if someone's cooking and there's music and preferably a glass of wine, it just goes even better. It just makes a mundane. And I say whenever I forget the music, it's easier to get stressed. Like doing dishes doesn't seem as mundane when you have something beautiful and people are on the table, and I'll usually just turn it down when we have dinner, but I'd say it's on 99% of the time whenever I'm cooking. So I think it's a huge impact. It's cooking with all senses.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what about you, Christine?
We have music on quite a bit, and I think for me, I love cooking, but especially during the stressors of the day, I think when it comes time to it, it can start being a chore. But music takes that away for me. I really like, and I don't even know all the names of the bands I listen to, but I have, you know, I have Spotify on the indie station, and it's fun because, you know, Lincoln sings along with me and dances in the kitchen. So, I think it just takes away that chore element from cooking. And like Anka said, it's cooking with all the senses.
Yeah, maybe we can try, by the time this airs, maybe we can try and pull together another playlist and share that with the listeners.
Totally.
Yeah, we should do that. So what other ways do you guys make an effort to live sustainably?
I've tried to reduce plastic quite a bit, you know, just eliminating even plastic wrap completely and just covering bowls with, you know, like linen wraps. Recycling everything and anything possible. What else? Gosh.
I started dropping off scraps. Sorry, Christine, I totally interrupted you.
No.
At the farmer's market, I think food waste is probably, it's a huge issue that mm-hmm. we didn't even realize until we started just writing our business plan and going into why meal planning works. So I didn't realize that we waste more food than we throw out plastic and metal and glass. I mean, it's pretty absurd in many ways, since I think in the States, I think we have around 14% of people can't get food on the table, and we're just throwing away 40% of food, and fruits and vegetables being the highest percentage of that. So that really struck a chord with me, because in general, I try to be green. Like, I'll try to pick up then not to buy paper towels as often as I used to. But it wasn't something – it didn't strike a chord as much. It wasn't super conscious. But when I started reading about food waste, it really struck a chord with me. In Romania, we never had any food scraps. All the food scraps actually went to the pigs. I mean, even eggshells.
Yep.
So it was just so sustainable. I mean, it was just kind of like your own – everything, and you used everything. You didn't throw out stuff. So, and then here, just kind of out of sight, out of mind, it's not a big deal. And then when I read about how it's doubled, I think since 1990, even just the amount of food waste that we give, and how horrible. I mean, environmental implications obviously are horrible, but just even from monetary. I mean, we're trying to save money. People think they can't shop at farmers markets because it's expensive, but then we waste half the food that we buy because we buy on impulse, or we just buy because it was on sale and then you don't know what to do with it, or you don't have time because you don't plan. Yeah, I think one of the things I've started is just dropping off food scraps. It's just, it's staggering, just the statistics about what we throw out. It's really sad. So yeah, that's my little thing. That's what I'm proud of, throwing away scraps.
Yeah, I know. That's fantastic. And so when you say dropping off food scraps, are you dropping them off to be composted?
Yes.
Or is it food?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
There's a we have like a really small food market right on the way when I drop off the boys. And they take food scraps at Tribeca Food Market. And they'll take it and then they go and compost it. So
awesome.
It's a nice way, especially living in the city. Everyone just comes with their bags and you drop it off. And it's amazing how little left of garbage you have, though.
Yeah.
After it's like half, if not less. It's unbelievable how much just the peels and everything else. And that's one of the things we've Christine and I even talked about, especially at mom's house. We want to start composting and just really learning more about it, because right now I'm obviously just dropping it off, but at least I know it's getting composted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny for me. I've always had the luxury of being able to compost, I guess, because we've always had a yard, you know, living.
Mm-hmm.
And so we always have, like, my whole entire life, we've just composted our own stuff. And it's just, like, normal. And it's funny. I didn't realize it wasn't normal for everyone.
No, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's so easy, like, literally. And I have to say, I don't manage my compost very well. I don't turn it as much as I should,
right.
And I don't, but it still breaks down. I mean, I have literally, we have one bin. It's maybe like 4 feet high, and I don't know how big, but it's not big. And it's never, ever full. And we cook a lot, and we cook mainly plant-based produce. All of that goes in there, and it's never, ever full. It does break down. It's crazy. And so it's super easy. It's really not a big deal at all.
No, but it's so, it saves. That little effort is so monumental in the end.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Between that and recycling, we throw out one tiny, tiny little grocery bag
that's
a quarter full every 2 weeks.
That's amazing.
That's it.
Awesome.
Yeah. So
it makes a difference.
It does, yeah. So good for you, Anka. That's awesome. All right, so last, I said that a couple questions ago, but I really mean it now. Last couple of questions. I've really enjoyed our talk together. What was it like trying to get a brand new company off the ground? So I'm sort of taking it back into the business sphere now. So what were your key strategies, and did you learn anything in the process that you don't mind sharing?
Well, where's the best place to start, I guess?
Business plan that we worked on really hard.
Yeah.
That honed in, it took it from being this, not lofty goal, but just kind of, there's a certain naivete to, oh, we're going to do this. It's going to be so easy. You just ask people to join. And then when you put it on paper and it's like, okay, well, how much is a website going to cost? And at first we're like, this website's going to cost what? 2,000-3,000. And then they're like, no, if people are going to have logins, this has to be built in. This is really expensive. And just so reality sorely sets. But for us, it was a business plan. It was a way for us to get everything down. And Christine has a background in finance, which has been amazing for us because she mm-hmm. handled all that. And she's super type A, which also helps a lot. But it was just, we got everything on paper and we looked at our goal projections and where we thought we stood. For me, the business plan was probably really big. But we both had Christine. We found out Christine was pregnant halfway into everything.
Yeah.
Actually,
and then there was no
even with that, the day after she gave birth, after not the day, the day she got released from the hospital, we work on our meal plans Thursday, and they go live Friday. And I'm not joking. Mm-hmm. She comes home with a newborn, and she's sitting at the desk. She's like, okay, we have to do final edits. She's like a two-day-old baby. It's just, we just worked it into our lives from
yeah.
the get-go. But, yeah, it wasn't easy. Lots of late nights, and it always takes longer than you think, and it's mm-hmm. always way more expensive than you think. And that's kind of what we've learned. But we were lucky enough to come across LendSpark, and we did our loan through them. Otherwise, it would have been really, really difficult. I know a lot of people can start businesses and just start off with zero, but for something like this, it was kind of you have to spend money to make money kind of
yeah.
thing. And it's like we both have very particular tastes. And we said whatever we start, we want to be really proud of, and that's probably going to cost money. It's not going to
mm-hmm.
be even when we said we wanted to launch, we have some like children's totes and then a journal and an adult tote. Even that, we said, you know, it has to be organic and it has to be local. So even the cotton, I think, is from Texas and it's sewn in Vermont. And the tags, we wanted to even have our wit on the tags. Like every little detail mattered. We said, if we're going to start something, it better be down to the core, even if no one reads it, but we know it's there. And that took,
yeah.
it took a lot, but there's nothing like making something of your own. I think Christine can totally second me on this. It's
yeah.
been, and one of the best blessings, I say, is probably Christine doing it alongside with me. And there's been so many times where I look at her, I'm like, we don't realize she thinks we're complete opposites, but we mesh perfectly. And to
mm-hmm.
have someone along, I could never have done this without her. So it's been quite the journey.
It mm-hmm. has been awesome. And I'd say after getting, you know, our strategic stuff down, it's really just taking that leap and not looking back. Because otherwise, I think you can get bogged down with, well, what if this happens?
Oh, yeah.
What if that happens? And then it's really just taking a leap of faith and going from there.
Right. I mean, it's true.
Yeah.
And it, yeah, you're right, Anka, that having that business plan down, it's humbling.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. But you guys have accomplished a lot, and Huckling Goose looks fantastic online. I was attracted the second they stopped by, and I see a lot of websites. So
thank you.
Yeah. You guys are doing a great job. And I meant to say before, when you talked about those children's totes, I saw those on your site, and I thought that was just like, cute. I meant to say before when you mentioned that, I really love that built it. Like, really, it's not about it being a cute accessory. It's about encouraging a child
yeah.
to enjoy shopping for fresh produce, and that's it's awesome.
They do. They carry that tote everywhere.
Yeah.
My boys,
yeah,
everywhere they go, they love it.
That's so great. So we're at the start of a new year, so what's coming up for you in 2015?
Oh man, big plans. I think we spent, you know, these last 6 months sort of just figuring out how to run like a well-oiled machine and we have different components built into our site to launch hopefully this coming year. That's our goal, but definitely at some point in the future. Right now, our meal plans sort of take broadly what's available across the country, and you know, we sort of take what's overlapping everywhere and create a meal plan that way. But we have a regional feature built into our website that, you know, we just have to build out and launch, but it'll just target specific regions and what's available specifically there, you know, by the week in real time. And that's how we'll start creating meal plans. And then we'll also be launching a custom feature as well, specifically to help people get the most out of their CSA boxes. Because I'm with you, Celine. I mean, I have one too, and this past month I've gotten radishes, I think like two bunches of radishes in every single box. So, you know, just figuring out what to do with that when you just have so much of something. But yeah, just continuing to grow and build our community. You know, our really big goal for Huckle and Goose is just that we want this like giant cooking community where everyone sort of feels like they're gathering together around this like digital communal table. And we want to keep growing that community.
Yeah, that regional functionality sounds incredible. So I'll look forward to sort of keeping up with that. And then, you know, it's worth mentioning at this time as well that we're going to have a special offer for Pure Green listeners to give a try to what you guys are doing so that they can experience it firsthand as well.
Yes.
So we'll share more in the show notes and at a later time, but just so that listeners know to look for that. So that's it. That's all the questions I had for you guys. And I really I really appreciated your time, and I think listeners will get a lot out of it. So thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thank you for having us, Celine.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
So that concludes my talk with Anka and Christine. Definitely go check out their website at hucklegoose.com. You'll love it, and hopefully it makes weeknight meal planning a lot easier. Don't forget as well to take advantage of their offer and get 35% off of a membership with the code PGMPODCAST. And we have one more surprise. Anka's put together a nice little playlist for you so you can cook with a little added joy. Find it along with the show notes at puregreenmag.com/podcast/hucklegoose. This podcast is created by Pure Green Magazine. Go to puregreenmag.com to pick up a copy of our latest issue or to subscribe. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Celine McKay, and I'll see you next week.